Thank you, Nico, for a kind introduction, and thank you everyone for giving me the pleasure of talking to you about things that I'm interested in, and I hope I can give you some of that enthusiasm for some of these topics. And we are here now in the age of exoplanets. Go back to the 90s, and we were the only planets in the universe. We didn't know of the existence of any others. And since the 90s, there have been discoveries of planets. With the Kepler mission, we now have statistics of how many planets are there, how many planets of each size are there. And it is inevitable that we will find Earth-sized planets at a kind of Earth-like radius around kind of sun-like stars. And hopefully in my career, we'll be able to characterize those planets. And I think that's going to be one of the biggest developments in science we're going to see in our lifetime. I think it's going to be, in some ways, analogous to discovering that the Earth actually orbits around the sun when we find that there either is or is not life on other planets. And I think that's something that's achievable in my professional lifetime. So the work I'm going to talk about today is towards understanding that. What do we need to know to understand what might we look for life? And when we look for life, what's it going to be like? What's going to control whether a planet is inhabited? So I like to be clear in my slides. So we'll start off with dogma today. And what is required for a planet to be habitable? Does anyone have a suggestion for that? Anyone, you can shout out one word.
Water.
Correct, you know the dogma. And then what controls planetary temperature? Anyone?
Moderate.
Sorry?
Moderate.
Moderate. Okay, so here's what we've got. Here's the dogma. If surface liquid water is equated with planetary habitability. So if we want to look for a habitable planet, we want to look for an environment where surface liquid water would be plausible. Now, I can think of examples in the solar system where we might have life on an icy planet like Enceladus, for example, or Europa. But that doesn't fit with the dogma, so we'll leave that till a little later. And then controls on planetary temperature, well, the amount of sunlight you have coming in, that is a first-order determinant. It does not control everything. The amount of sunlight received by Earth has increased 30% through Earth history due to stellar evolution, and Earth has got colder through its evolution. So that's not all the picture. So really atmospheric composition, how much atmosphere do we have, what are the greenhouse gases, and so on, is what's going to determine the climate and thus the habitability. Are mesophile organisms going to do okay? So, we'll start off with water. And it's unusual amongst our atmospheric gases in that we have a large condensed reservoir. It's in fact the only gas, the only atmospheric gas, for which physics is any use in understanding its abundance in the atmosphere. Physics is an absolute unmitigated failure for all the rest of the gases. I take particular pleasure telling that to a physics department. So here is the range of temperature and pressure conditions on Earth. And it sits nicely over the triple point. So we have solid, liquid, and vapor. In fact, we have all of them in Toronto today, or at least yesterday. And that turns out to make it really complicated and difficult. And well, water is the only gas for which physics does any good. It turns out the physics is really rich and interesting. So we'll talk about that for a little bit. The first one is that the reflectivity of solid and liquid ice are very different. The ocean is going to absorb 90% of the sunlight coming in. It'll reflect 10%, whereas snow and ice are going to reflect more like 60%, up to 80s or 90s for fresh snow. So there's a consequence, which is you build up Let's start here. This is us today. And let's build up a bigger ice cap. By the time that ice cap gets to the mid-latitudes, Earth is going to be reflecting so much sunlight away that we'll actually drop straight into global glaciation, glaciers down to the equator. There are, you know, drawn on this diagram, three different stable, steady states for ice lines, separated, of course, by unstable, steady states. So anyone who wants to experiment with that, get a dining room chair, you're in one stable state, lean back until you can just balance, that's your unstable, steady state, fall over and smack your head on the ground. And that's the process here. We lean back, we let the ice line get to lower latitudes, and we fall back and smack our head. That is, we get global glaciation. So, if you like surface water that is liquid, yes, let's get them all in, this is going to appear to be a little problematic for you. And this may be towards the outer edge of the habitable zone. Now, have we got another slide here? Well, this is another slide saying the same thing. This is different stable states. Three stable, steady states at present insulation. We, right here, have small ice caps. We could get rid of them quite easily. We're doing our best to get rid of them. So we could have an entirely ice-free planet. We could also, if there was a rapid cooling event, with the same atmospheric composition, with the same insulation, we could go to an entirely glaciated planet. This is kind of relevant to thinking about planetary evolution because there's a contingency of evolution. If I show you a planet and I tell you how much sunlight it's getting, you can't tell me what its climate is. You need to know its history, too. That's fun. So this is what's happened on Earth. And we have time going back here in billions of years. Earth is, of course, 4.5 billion years old, but the geological record is pretty bad before 3 or 3.5. There's not enough evidence to really know if there was glaciation or absence of glaciation. And it turns out that these low-latitude glaciations happened at two times, around 2.3 billion years ago, and then around 700 million years ago. So from that, we learn something. We actually learn that low-latitude glaciation doesn't kill a planet. And we know that because you're sitting here. Because there's been one continual lineage of life all the way through here, and it's taken these 4 billion years to get to pseudo-intelligent life like us. There's two ways to think about it. The first is that you actually just need patches of open water at the equator. We've got fairly good evidence for that now. That, yes, the ice was to the equator, but not quite everywhere. You had little patches of open water, like you have sea ice leads in the Arctic. The second thing is, if you imagine taking a gerbil, and you're careful in how you freeze that gerbil, and even more careful in how you thaw it out, that gerbil will still be able to run through the maze that you taught it to run through before. This was done in the 50s. These were early cryogenics experiments. So you can freeze a gerbil, so you can freeze a planet, and it'll just be just fine. What you don't want to do is roast it. If you put the same gerbil in the oven, it won't be any good at anything. It turns out to defrost it, you do actually use a microwave. That was what the first microwave was built for, defrosting gerbils. I'm not making this up. So complication number two is water vapor is a greenhouse gas. We know that. And the amount, what have I got written down here? So the vapor pressure depends exponentially on temperature. You could see that from the phase diagram. The radiative forcing from a greenhouse gas depends on the logarithm of the abundance of greenhouse gas. So you convolve those two and you get a linear positive feedback on temperature. We warm the Earth up a little bit. We get more water vapor in the atmosphere. We have a stronger greenhouse effect. That is called the water vapor feedback, and it is a linear positive feedback. And that works in temperate conditions. You go to somewhere warm, like the Earth's tropics, and you get to the edge of that linear regime. And I'm going to talk about that because it's important to habitability. So this is what we do. We let the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere become large. So we need an equation here, but fortunately we have a blackboard. If I could only find a spare bit of space that's not covered by a screen and a board rubber, and hope everyone sees. The one equation we need for this bit is Beer's law. Where F1 is our transmitted radiation, F0 is our incident radiation going through some medium, and tau is the optical depth. So we're going to build up the amount of water in the atmosphere so that optical depth reaches unity and then becomes larger than unity. And that's, of course, easy to do because of the exponential dependence of saturation vapor pressure on temperature. So we're going to build water vapor up in the atmosphere, so the atmosphere is optically thick. The consequence of that is that radiation emitted from the surface isn't going to be able to get out to space. Because we can only emit from where optical depth is unity up to 10, and that'll be achieved somewhere in the atmosphere. So only a layer in the atmosphere is going to be able to emit to space, and we don't care about the surface temperature anymore. So let's show you some pictures of this. So on the left, I've got five panels here for increasing temperature, surface temperature, from 280 up to 400 Kelvin. So this is a little bit like the modern, and this is a little bit like the mid-latitudes, I guess, and this is a little warmer than the tropics. On the left-hand side, we've got the height at which optical depth is unity in the atmosphere, and the colours at the back of atmospheric temperature. And then on the right-hand side, we've got the thermal emission from the Earth. And you can see for somewhere like here, it looks rather like the Planck function here, with some chunks taken out by gaseous absorption. In the red here, we put CO2 in, so you can see that 15 micron absorption, and then this is some water absorption here. Now, the grey line is the Planck function. And as we go to hotter surface temperatures, this is the Planck function of the surface. This is the Planck function of the surface. But we're not emitting that much because we're just emitting from that atmospheric layer. You can see that optical depth is unity is moving up in the atmosphere here. And it always seems to be about this boundary of the blue and orange, which you can link up onto the colour scale here. So we make the surface warmer, we propagate warmth up into the atmosphere, and the emission level goes up, but it stays at a constant temperature. Hence the total energy that we emit, the integral of the outgoing long-wave radiation here, turns out to be a constant. And this phenomenon is known as the runaway greenhouse. And we can do exactly the same, going to even higher temperatures. We're up to 1,200, 1,800 Kelvin surface temperatures up here. At 1,800, we can emit through the 4-micron water vapor window. But until we get there, the amount of thermal emission that we can get out of a planet is a constant. And that constant is, for clear skies, is 283 watts per square meter. So if you imagine, let's do this without clouds for the moment, because clouds make things difficult. If you imagine the Earth received 284 watts per square meter of radiation, it can only emit 283. This is a physics department, therefore you will understand that the world therefore must get hotter, and it will get hotter until it can emit more than 284 watts per square meter, which is up here at 1600 Kelvin, and that'll be a bad day for the gerbil, or in fact a bad day for the whole planet. So this is a hard boundary on the inner edge of the habitable zone. You move your planet near enough to the sun, or you turn the sun up, such that you absorb more radiation than this radiation limit, and you will cook the planet. So that's a hard, hard boundary on where you can have liquid water on a planet. So that's one thing we know. Now, you might say, I'm just a theoretician. What do I know about the atmosphere? These are just model output. So, I give you data. And this is from a satellite meteorology project looking at Earth's tropics, because we thought, well, we're expecting to get this runaway greenhouse effect at temperatures which we should be able to sample in the tropics. So we did this, and we looked at columns which were somewhat saturated in water. We filtered out desert areas, basically, and then we looked at what the distribution of outgoing long-wave radiation was as a function of sea surface temperature, and we see it go up, which is what you'd think it would do, and then it comes to a peak, and then it starts to go down again. That transition happens about 27 Celsius, which is curious, because 27 is a kind of canonical number when deep convection starts to initiate. That's probably not a coincidence. In black here are our model results. So we actually fit them quite well, apart from our models are a little optimistic in how much radiation we can get out. This looks a little better if we do it in water column space, and you just see that beautiful asymptote there to the radiation limit. So this is interesting and novel. We took a planetary science problem and then went and looked at the Earth's tropics, and we see it there. And I think something that will come out of this is the super greenhouse that's talked about in the tropics and in terrestrial meteorology, and the runaway greenhouse that's talked about in the planetary science literature are probably one and the same phenomenon. We're writing this up right now. So earlier I showed you a graph where we looked at the different stable states of a planet with considering glaciers. And we can put in these runaway greenhouse processes in that as well and show that we have different stable states because of the atmospheric water vapor. This is our runaway greenhouse state. It should extend all the way down here, but I just stopped running the model at 220 Kelvin. And then we've got a modern-like climate here. And then we've got a runaway greenhouse-like climate here. And these calculations are for pure water atmosphere with no oxygen or nitrogen. This is a fun little climate state here to appeal to the atmospheric physicists. This is when increased Rayleigh scattering on account of a thickening atmosphere as we evaporate more water has a negative feedback on surface temperature because more Rayleigh scattering is dominating over an increased greenhouse. I don't know if it would be physically realized, but it's a fun model result. But I'd like you to focus on this climate state here, which we're going to call modern. That's where we are. It's a cold, damp climate in an atmosphere of just pure water. And we're varying solar constant here, and what we can see is there's only a very small range of solar constant where we can have the kind of climate we have now. That would make the habitable zone around a star, that is where you could put a planet where you get liquid water, incredibly narrow. Now, this is, of course, wrong, because we want to have a water at colder temperatures. Well, what could we do? We could put greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And we could also put in some background atmosphere, some non-radiatively active species like nitrogen. That would be the best one. And they'll pressure broaden the absorption, of the relatively active species, so pump up the greenhouse effect, or we just pump more CO2 in and pump up the greenhouse effect. So that will mean that we can have habitable planets at lower solar constant. And if we want to go to higher solar constant and have a habitable planet, well, then I just fill the atmosphere up with nitrogen, because the nitrogen will give Rayleigh scattering. That's scattering by molecules, so we'll scatter away sunlight before it can get to the surface. So by altering CO2, nitrogen, other gases, we can expand the habitable zone from the region that we would get with just a pure water atmosphere, and there may be more life in the universe, or more space for habitable planets, at least. So that's what we're going to go on and do a little later on in the talk. We're going to look at what controls those other atmospheric gases. Just a little plot here of the same thing for water worlds, just to say that the size of the planet matters too. These are different shapes for different size planets. The reason for that is that the height of optical depth of unity will get really quite high on a diminutive planet like Mars and will be squished down on a large terrestrial planet. The word super-Earth is not to be used for large terrestrial planets. That is a weasel word which confuses people. Earth is special. Earth is special because of all of us. So there's to be no going calling planets where all we know is the radius or the mass and it just happens to be big. There's no conflating them with Earth, because Earth is special because of life. You can call something an Earth twin or a super Earth when you've done life detection, but not before. Just another little point on that habitable zone, looking in planetary mass space, is we have, just to emphasize, we have these overlapping states. Let's take this region here, we could have a runaway greenhouse. This region here, we could have this hot and moist climate state, that weird one that was about Rayleigh scattering negative feedback. Or we could have the cold, damp conditions here. So if you find a planet that's some distance from a star, well, you want to know its mass to start with, but then you also want to know its history if you want to know what its climate is. And of course, you don't know its history. So when you hear reports of discoveries of planets in the habitable zone, don't let yourself get confused into thinking it's going to have an Earth-like temperature. It could be in a runaway greenhouse. It could be in a snowball Earth, anywhere through here, in fact. It could be in any of a number of climate states. We need information about the atmosphere to know anything about the climate. The Kepler team were particularly bad at this in their press releases, because they've got their wonderful mission and they want to sell their results, and they kept saying, we found a planet with a temperature of this, and it's like, no, you haven't. You know nothing about that planet apart from it's there, and that it is there is cool enough. So, this runaway greenhouse physics is actually quite general. You can do it with any volatile species. We've got water up here. You can do it with carbon dioxide, ammonia, methane. It's a general problem in planetary atmospheres, and it was fundamentally identified by Kobayashi in the 60s. Here's an interesting point. CO2, you can do a runaway greenhouse with. Or conversely, if you make the planet cold enough, all your CO2 would collapse into an ocean. Or actually, it would collapse into ice. So the outer edge of the habitable zone really comes about from the same physics. If you have little sunlight, you'll want to stack the atmosphere full of carbon dioxide. But then your amount of sunlight coming in becomes too small, and that CO2 will collapse. And that is really your hard outer edge of the habitable zone, when you start getting CO2 condensation into clouds and ultimately atmospheric collapse, is your outer edge. Mars today has CO2 ice cap, so you can see that Mars is sitting just around the outer edge of the habitable zone. When gases become condensable, physics starts becoming useful again. So let's take a little trip into the outer solar system and talk about Titan here. Titan is a moon of Saturn. I tend to talk about terrestrial moons as planets because the only difference is they're orbiting another bigger planet rather than a star. The planetary science is all the same. And Titan is brown here because of a rich organic haze in its atmosphere. Titan is made 50% of water. Its bulk composition is 50% water. But that water is all ice, because these are the temperature pressure conditions on Titan. Plenty of water, but it's not seen as being habitable for things like us because it's too cold. That is where we are now in temperature pressure space. So this is the early photo of Titan from the Huygens lander, and these pebbles here are probably pebbles of water. So water behaves like rock if you make it cold enough. Rock behaves like rock on Earth because it's cold, relatively, if you're a rock. You can melt rocks, evaporate rocks, that's just fine. We do it in volcanoes. Temperature and pressure on Titan compared to Earth. That's not what I'm talking about. Here's the triple point of methane, and that's actually just what Titan conditions are like. So on Titan, there's a methanological cycle in the same way as a hydrological cycle on Earth. You can see before and after photos. Here is somewhere without lakes. Here is somewhere with lakes. And those are lakes of liquid methane. So methane, if you make the planet colder, will behave like water does on Earth. It'll be a nice, physically well-behaved, condensable gas. It turns out that Titan is just around the threshold for a runaway greenhouse of methane, in the same way that Earth is just hovering near the threshold for a runaway greenhouse for water. There might be something profound in that. So, we're going to take a little sidestep now. And this came about because at an exoplanets conference in the summer, I was asked to give a talk about the habitability of water worlds. And I was a bit confused by this until I realized that everyone talked about what if you made a whole planet out of water, but no one really wrote papers on it. And I'd accidentally written a paper with that in the title. Then I understood the talk. And I thought, well, that paper isn't quite the talk they wanted. So I started just thinking about what if we change the water inventory on a planet? What classes of planet can I come up with? And this is a hand-drawn diagram because I drew it whilst my car was in the shop after dying while I was at a planetary science summer school. So it's a hand-drawn diagram. Here we are. We've got oceans and we've got 30% land. But what if we just turn down the amount of water? Let's turn it right down. Let's have 30 parts per million in the atmosphere. We'll call that Venus. Or we could just have a desert planet with small polar caps of water. And we're going to call that Dune. Who's read Dune? The rest of you have got homework. It's broadly right in terms of the astrobiology. Titan, if you replace the... Titan's got lakes of methane, but if you can think of those as lakes of water too, just have isolated lakes, mostly land. We could go to just having little islands poking out, no islands, no shallow water, or an ocean so thick that at the bottom of the ocean, rather than getting to rock, we got to high-pressure ice phases. So ocean and rock never meet. Keep that in mind. We're going to come back to it. asking the question, how will just the amount of water determine habitability? Well, let's start with a dune-class planet. A runaway greenhouse is really difficult on dune because there isn't enough water. And getting to CO2 condensation, the way you do that is form global water glaciers first to cool it down, and then you'll get the CO2 condensation. But on dune, you haven't got enough water to cover the entire planet in ice. So if we have these boundaries of the habitable zone, runaway greenhouse, snowball Earth leading to CO2 condensation, the habitable zone for dune is much wider than for Earth because we've got rid of most of the water which is causing us problems. We require water to be habitable, but the physics gets messy and gives us these hard boundaries on habitability. So, from a physics point of view, dune is far more habitable than Earth. Now, let's start getting real and deal with atmospheric composition. These are the processes, Rayleigh scattering, and a greenhouse effect. And these are the main gases responsible. And then this is what controls the amount of these gases we have. Water vapor here is physical. Everything else, it's biology. And biology's hard. Geology, too. Geology is pretty difficult as well. This is what we do if we change nitrogen, as an example. Nitrogen is radiatively inactive at Earth kind of temperatures. There's Rayleigh scattering, for sure, but it doesn't absorb or emit radiation well. But what it will do is pressure broaden the absorption lines of the radiatively active gases. You know, if I'm a CO2 molecule, I'm standing here, I'll absorb a particular wavelength of light at each absorption line. And those lines are very narrow. So if I'm a CO2, just sitting out as a loner in the atmosphere, I'm not going to absorb much radiation. But if you're all nitrogen molecules, and you're all running around, so you're barging into me, and I get knocked around here and there and everywhere, I'm going to have all these extra motions. And that's going to mean that I can absorb radiation at a much wider range of wavelengths. So we really kind of pump up the strength of our greenhouse gases with background gases like nitrogen. So we're increasing CO2 here, and then increasing nitrogen from the present to 2 or 3 times or less nitrogen. And you can see that increasing CO2 warms the planet, and increasing nitrogen will warm the planet too. If we get too much nitrogen, then the Rayleigh scattering is going to start to take over, and it'll be a cooling. So we want to control CO2 and nitrogen. Let's do nitrogen first. It is a fact that most of the nitrogen is not in the atmosphere, it is in the solid Earth. Now, the reason for this is that nitrogen is used by biology, and biology will fix it from N2 to ammonium. And ammonium has the same charge and a similar ionic radii to potassium. And potassium, you find in a lot of crustal rocks, particularly in clays, that kind of thing. So you can just, if you have, it's one of those things in geochemistry, if you have the same charge and the same radius, you can just substitute in mineral lattices. So we substitute ammonium for potassium in mineral lattices. And then that potassium's in rocks and it can get subducted into the mantle. So we transfer nitrogen from the atmosphere to the biosphere, to the sediments, to the rocks, to the mantle. And we can equivalently put it into continental crust. It turns out, for a reason I'll show you on the next slide, that the nitrogen in the mantle is of this subducted origin. Any nitrogen there to begin with must have been outgassed, and then the mantle regassed with nitrogen. The regassing timescale with the present rate of subduction takes about 1 billion years. So we can just flux the atmosphere through the mantle. And it's biology and geology that are doing that. Here's a little bit of explanation for that. I've got a graph here where I've got nitrogen divided by argon-36 and argon-40 divided by argon-36. Now, argon is relevant here as a noble gas because in mantle melt, argon has the same solubility as nitrogen. So argon is a useful tracer. And what we find is that nitrogen, we get a line here. We've plotted nitrogen over 36 and argon 40 over 36, and almost everything fits on this one line. So that's saying that nitrogen is correlating with argon 40. Now, argon 40 is the decay product of potassium 40. So this is the diagram that's showing us that nitrogen correlates with potassium. Potassium really doesn't like to be in the mantle. It likes to be in the crust. So potassium getting back into the crust is a subduction, into the mantle, sorry, is a subduction signature. Nitrogen doesn't correlate with argon 36, which is primordial. So that's how we know that the mantle must have outgassed early, and it's now regassed. So this is really cool, okay? This is our bulk atmospheric constituent, and it's getting fluxed in and out of the Earth by biological and geological processes. So, you're not excited by that. But we'll talk about other planets anyway. A small planet like Mars, we only need to look at it and see the sorry state of affairs. It has pretty much nothing left of an atmosphere. It's got a little bit of an atmosphere. The Martians would get upset with me. But it's all gone. The atmosphere's all been lost. We go to a dead planet, and the mantle, I think, will be thoroughly degassed. We'll have a thick nitrogen atmosphere. Now, we go to one of those planets with an ice-bottomed ocean, and how are we going to substitute nitrogen for potassium in minerals if we can't get to the minerals because there's so much water that we can't see the rock because of the high-pressure ice phases covering it? So, the bulk volatile inventory of a planet, I think, is really going to affect its habitable zone. Because the atmospheric composition, I've talked here about nitrogen, determines the region where you could have habitable climate. But if we do is change the water inventory of the planet, and we can change that, or we change the planet's size, all these things are things we're going to have to take into account. So when you hear people talk about habitable zone planets, remember to ask questions. How big is it? What's its volatile inventory? What's its history? What did it have for breakfast? No. Let's do carbon dioxide as well. And for the young planet, there are choices to be made. This is Venus. Venus made a certain set of choices. This, of course, is on the Earth. This is Beachy Head in Sussex in southeast England. And these are Cretaceous age chalks. Brendan, when is the Cretaceous? You see, former students of mine who sit in the audience get picked on sometimes. So, and you didn't take my second year class. Okay, you're forgiven. So this is chalk here. Chalk's a kind of limestone, a kind of calcium carbonate rock. This is made up out of microfossils. This is just a giant graveyard here of organisms which build their shells out of calcium carbonate. This is Venus, where all the carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere. There's a 90 bar atmosphere, mostly carbon dioxide. If you took all of these carbonate rocks from Earth, and you bake them off. The industrial process by which we do that is called a lime kiln. You bake them all off, and you'd have a 90 bar carbon dioxide atmosphere on Earth, because Earth and Venus turn out to have the same bulk volatile inventory. Venus keeps all its carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Earth keeps all its carbon dioxide in biologically formed limestones. Biology. So we're going to have to do some chemistry now. It's getting worse. Dissolved inorganic carbon is the sum of all the inorganic carbon species in the ocean. And then we've got this other property called alkalinity, which is the net negative charge associated with these inorganic carbon species. So we've got conservation of mass and conservation of charge. This is easy. Now, how you speciate between these three different species is going to depend both on the DIC and the alkalinity. So we plot a parameter space here. And if we're going to precipitate calcium carbonate, then we want the carbonate ion concentration to be high. And you can see that that requires high alkalinity relative to DIC. We're all over on this edge of the plot. So we want to get alkalinity into the ocean in order to be able to deposit calcium carbonate. Alkalinity comes from weathering rocks. So this is a geochemical problem. You weather rocks on the continent or on the or ultra ocean crust on the ocean floor, and you get an alkalinity flux in, and then you can deposit carbonate. And the biology does the work of the depositing carbonate. Now, here's a sketch of all the processes involved to deposit carbonate. We have alkalinity coming from the continent, from weathering of rock, which is often biologically mediated. We have exchange processes with the atmosphere. We precipitate carbonate in the surface ocean. It gets more soluble with depth, so it will dissolve as you go down. So our carbonate deposits are mainly on shelf seas. And as I say, biology is involved in the weathering and also in the precipitation here. So let's go back to our sketch of different planets. Well, if we're dune or drier, it's going to be really difficult to deposit carbonates because this is aqueous chemistry. Titan-like or wetter, well, then we've got a chance. We can deposit carbonates. So if the planet's too dry, we're going to have problems managing our CO2 inventory. These ones start to get fun too. Because if we've got no shelf seas, no shallow bits of the ocean, we've got nowhere to put those sediments, because by the time it's sunk all the way down here, it's going to have dissolved again. So CO2 management actually maybe depends on having a middling amount of water there. Whether this is correct or not, I don't know. We will know this when we actually have data from planets, and data for the depths of the ocean is going to be really difficult to get. Unless someone in here is a better physicist than I am and can figure out how to do that. And if you do, I'll buy you at least 20 beers. After you've told me how. Productivity is shown here. It is nutrient limited. Productivity near the coast and in upwelling zones where we've got nutrients coming in. Middle of the oceans, it's dead as a doornail. Let's go back up here. Well, let's go down. Let's see. Yeah. We need to weather rocks to get those nutrients in. So again, you get a planet that's too wet, a real water world, I worry about life. I worry for it. So most of this, what have I done? I've told you about the habitable zone. I've told you about some of the controls on it from atmospheric physics. And then we've leveraged the atmospheric physics. You know, what does CO2 do? What does nitrogen do? And then what I've shown is that we need to consider the biology and the geology of a planet to know if it's habitable or not. Now, I said biology, and that implies the planet is inhabited. So I wonder if we have a paradox here, that habitability depends on the action of biology. That is, habitability depends on whether the planet is inhabited or not. So I suppose we may have a little bit of an inhabitance paradox here. Now, all of this, of course, we're going to do better when we have more data. So the last slide is the commercial break, which is to talk a little bit about a mission that I'm involved in. What we want to do to find out more about planets is direct imaging. We want to collect photons from a planet and see what photons we get, and that way we can start to characterize the planet. At a simple level, we want to say we're going to take a photograph of the planet. Earth is blue. We know that, and that's because of liquid water oceans. Mars is red. That's because it's dry, it's got this heavily oxidized surface, oxidized iron. Titan, brown, organic haze. Venus, white, sulfuric acid clouds. The speaker from 2 weeks ago, Dave Crisp, described sulfuric acid as God's reflector. It is so good at reflecting. Or you can have another white, which is Europa, say, an ice-covered world. Either very hot or very cold, and it's still white. That's an interesting degeneracy. So let's say we want the colour of a planet. Well, we're going to need a space telescope to do that. And if you look at a planet far away, you're going to need a very big space telescope because you've got the star and the planet right next to it, so you're at the diffusion limit of the optics. But if you look at a nearer planet, let's just look at Alpha Centauri, IMB, which is 4.5 light years away. The diffusion limit you can deal with a 50-centimeter telescope. And you can get a 50-centimeter telescope and put it into space at a very good price point nowadays, 25 to 50 million. And we want to do this because this will be the first way we can directly image an exoplanet. If we find that there's an Earth-like planet in the Alpha Centauri system, find it by direct imaging, then we can characterize it. And this kind of mission is too cheap for a space agency. And apparently the null result isn't interesting. Well, we don't find a planet, okay, we wasted $25 million. But if we do find a planet, it's the most amazing thing ever. Because we're the first people to characterize an Earth-sized planet, and we've done it for $25 million. So I'm involved in this project called Project Blue, which is trying to fund this mission as a private mission. The money's going to come from, I guess, a variety of partners, probably some from some very rich people who got rich on tech and thought this kind of thing is cool. But we want to raise the first $1 million on a Kickstarter. So if any of you think this kind of thing is cool, please share the information about this project. Or even, you know, I'm on the project team and I put some money in, you know? So feel free to have a look at this project, tell your friends about it. I'd love this to get funded up to $1 million so we can get the initial science of this project done and then go finding planets. Okay, on that shameless commercial, I will end. Yeah.
Does that mean there's life, or are there other kinds of blue?
Blue is a liquid water ocean. Now, the way we're going to detecting an ocean is going to be like, damn, that's cool. Because it's telling us a certain amount about the temperature of the planet. I actually think if you had an ocean planet that was really warm, it would get very cloudy rather quickly. So if we actually see something that's blue, it's probably about the same temperature as Earth as well. It's not too cold, because that would be white, and it's not too hot, because that would be cloudy. So we've actually got a lot of information if it turns out to be blue. Then we actually need a space telescope with a very capable, to do capable spectrometry with it. I pronounced that wrong, never mind, you all know what I mean. We need a spectrum from it. And that's going to be a bigger, more expensive telescope. But at the point at which you find a target, and you say, sitting there at Alpha Centauri, there's a planet with a liquid water ocean that you can see, my expectation would be space agencies queuing up to build that kind of bigger, multi-billion dollar telescope. Yeah, that's a really great question. So the way to do atmospheric analysis is to look at the spectrum. And there is the original theory of how to do this was done in the 60s by James Lovelock, who was later famous for Gaia hypothesis. Previously, he was the person who was microwaving gerbils. And what Lovelock showed was that what you need to find... What we have in Earth's atmosphere is pervasive disequilibrium. So we've got oxygen and we've also got methane in the atmosphere. The lifetime of the methane is 10 years in 21% oxygen. So we require a constant flux of both gases. And we can rule out everything except biology as providing sufficient fluxes of those gases. So that's how you do life detection. You have to look for combinations of gases that can be explained no other way than life. Now, your ability to detect different gases at low concentrations depends on a couple of things. It depends on the size of the mirror, and it depends on the spectral resolution, and then it obviously depends on, you know, how you can deal with noise and how much time you spend pointing. There isn't one answer to your original question, but those are the ideas. I think it's likely. I think it's actually quite likely that there is... Well, no, let's put it a different way. Either life is profoundly rare in the universe, profoundly rare, such that we are the only kind, only life. But if not, I don't see why life wouldn't be... We couldn't have other forms of life. It's a little difficult to go look for because we're looking for something that we don't know what it looks like. And that's harder than looking for something that we do know what it looks like. Now, one of the reasons that I do not think there should be a lander on Titan is I don't think it's theoretically excluded that there could be some kind of weird life on Titan that's just going along really, really slowly. Because if you're living in on a 90 Kelvin surface, you'd do everything pretty damn slowly. But there's all these organic... there's all these organics kicking around, you know. There's the hazers are, you know, raining out, you know, higher hydrocarbons. So there's energy to be had there. So I don't know that we'd know if there was life there because it'd be going so slowly. So we shouldn't contaminate Titan. I think we probably will by putting a lander on it, but I'm not in favour of that. I think there and then there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what I'm talking about when I'm in disequilibrium is there is Gibbs free energy to be had from the atmosphere. Is that the atmosphere is way out of chemical equilibrium. And you see that in Earth, and the classic example is oxygen and methane. Also, N2 actually, with this amount of oxygen, we might expect it to be in nitrate more than N2, which is curious, there's other things involved in that. So I would say in doing life detection on other planets, the way I would like to do it would be get as high a resolution spectrum as possible and just try to figure out what is in the atmosphere. That's going to be hard enough. That's going to be that's going to be very hard. It's also going to be very expensive. So there are people in the community who like to talk about biomarker gases. Like oxygen is a biomarker. And that's a much weaker theoretical approach. But maybe it will be the first one that's taken. Because I can suggest you ways of making oxygen in an atmosphere abiologically. But you find oxygen and, well, it'll motivate a bigger, more expensive mission. So maybe we have to be pragmatic about that. And first we go look for biomarkers, but we should then be careful not to be the boy who cried wolf.
Mm-hmm. We're not necessarily looking at their atmospheres, which I realize you have been mm-hmm. doing. What's your opinion about the possibility of life as we kind of know it in the water without oxygen, without atmospheric oxygen?
Yeah. Well, oxygen isn't necessary for life. Oxygen is a toxic byproduct.
Right.
Oxygen is the worst thing for most of the life on Earth. We just happen to be adapted to use it. So I'll go back to the main point of the question, which is, what about life in the subsurface, liquid water on Enceladus, on Europa, maybe even on the Plutoid? I think we should build a mission to fly through the plumes of Enceladus and sample them. I think we need a really capable mission to do organics detection, potential life detection by sampling the plumes of Enceladus. So Enceladus is a Saturn moon. Yes, I think it's Saturn system. Yeah, which has got geysers coming out. They're just spewing material from the inside of the planet out into space. So that's a perfect astrobiology experiment because you can sample it without touching the planet, without any risk of contamination, and without needing a lander, which are expensive and go wrong often. You just have to get into orbit, and you just keep flying through that plume and keep sampling it. So what do I think about it? I think we should go find out.
I've got one question. We know pretty much that there was liquid water on Mars for some time.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to accept full responsibility for which I must have slightly mis-explained that. We have had 4 billion years of liquid water on Earth, and that's really weird, being able to keep a fairly narrow range of temperature conditions for so long is weird. And Earth is weird. Mars, well, it does look like there's liquid water for a while. But then that went away. And also on Mars, we don't know if there was actually continual liquid water through that early Mars period, or whether the liquid water features were formed in catastrophic events. Let's say you hit a big asteroid into Mars, deliver a lot of energy, melt all the polar caps, catastrophic floods, and then you freeze all the water back onto polar caps. That could give you the geomorphology on Mars. You could also do it. There's other mechanisms by which you could do it. So liquid water, I don't think, has to... liquid water doesn't have to imply life, I think would be the answer. When you have 4 billion years of near constant liquid water, something funny has been happening, and that's when you might start asking questions about life.
I come back to this 4.4 billion year old water on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
There are even suggestions from Zircon that it could be 4.4.
Mm-hmm.
no life.
Okay.
It was habitable, but not habitable.
Okay, so I'm going to answer this question quickly because I see people going. So, the record of water and life on Earth. If we've had water for a long time, what is the evidence of life? Well, the oldest evidence of life on Earth is from a recently exposed section of the Ischua supercrustal belt in Greenland, which was recently exposed because of glacier retreat. Climate change is good for science. It gives us new Archean-Hadean boundary sections in Greenland. And there are some beautiful stromatolites exposed in those fossils there. And stromatolites are biosedimentary structures. You get mat organisms which grow and entrain sediments in them. And, you know, will grow in like maybe shapes like that or shapes like that because they're growing up towards the sun. So back in Ischua, someone recently discovered, and it was a Nature paper, of course, some beautiful stromatolites in 3.95-billion-year-old rocks. So there's photosynthesis, not necessarily oxygen-producing photosynthesis. It could have been another kind, you know, using iron as the electron donor, for example. But there was photosynthesis at 3.95 billion years old in the first sedimentary sequences that are well-preserved. We find evidence of life. On that, I think I will finish.